You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. Hello? Good afternoon. I'm David Wessel. I'm director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy here at Brookings. And on behalf of our center, the Olin School of Business at WashU in St. Louis, the Rosenberg Institute of Global Finance at the Brandeis International Business School, and the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago, I want to welcome to you to this, the 7th Annual Municipal Finance Conference. I want to thank particularly the people on our advisory committee, many of whom are here, we'll recognize them later, for helping us organize this and collect papers. This conference has an interesting history. It began as a collaboration between Rich Reifel, who was in the municipal capital markets business and at WashU, and Dan Bergstresser at Brandeis, as a way to bring together academics who are interested in municipal finance and people who are in that industry. This is the third year we've been doing it here at Brookings, and our goal is to broaden it to not only people who are in the municipal capital markets, but also and people who are academics, but also people who are in the public sector, issuers, and regulators, because the point of a think tank like Brookings is to improve the quality of public policy. We've also tried to So it's an unusual marriage, and I think one of the conference's unique features is it tries to bring together people who don't often interact and who, as I've discovered, often don't speak the same language. So this is an act of translation. We've also tried to broaden it to state and local fiscal issues in general, largely because we think they're understudied relative to their importance. As all of you know, the municipal bond market is huge, $3.9 trillion, about 45% the size of the corporate bond market. There are 50,000 issuers, five times the corporate bond market. But also there are tons of people who, I've forgotten the number, who are employed by state and local governments. And then, of course, there's even larger number who actually live in state and local jurisdictions. So we think this is a topic worthy of more study than it gets, and our goal here is to stimulate and discuss rigorous academic quality literature, whether it's by an academic or somebody else, and to foster dialogue between people who are in the business and people who study it. A few ground rules. This entire conference is on the record. The sessions that are plenary sessions are going to be videoed and are web streamed live, as is the panel we'll have tomorrow afternoon. For the benefit of people who are watching online or who may be in the back of the room, if you have a comment to make, please wait for a microphone or use one of the microphones if you're sitting up here on the panel. The general format will be the paper author will come up. One of the authors present for 15 minutes max. We'll have timers in the front row. The discussant will have 10 minutes max, and then we'll have time for 15 minutes of Q&A with the audience. And, of course, there'll be plenty of opportunity for additional conversation on the sidelines. I am going to ask people to kind of honor the – not to – to honor those time limits, because in many of the sessions we have three papers, and if the first two papers go over, the person who gets screwed is the one who happened to be the third presenter, and that's not fair. All of the papers and all of the slides are already posted on our website, so you're welcome to look at them. There's coffee out here. The bathrooms are that way to the back. Our maintenance staff would be grateful if when you leave the room, if you have papers or coffee cups at your feet, if you bring them to the back of the room where there's waste baskets. The people from the Hutchins Center staff, several of them, many of them have little orange dots. So if you need instructions or are lost or how do you get on the Wi-Fi or something, they're happy to help you. We'll start with a session in here in a few minutes. Then we'll divide. Some of the sessions will be in Saul Zilka, which is just across here. Some will be in this room. You're welcome to come to whatever ones you want. a moment, just one logistical thing I want to mention. As you know, the dinner tonight is at the Capitol Hilton, which is not very far from here, but it's pretty hot and humid. Ben Watkins was complaining that he came to Washington from Florida hoping to avoid the Florida weather, and I accused him of bringing the Florida weather with him, so we can have that out later. After the second break, after the breakout sessions end around 5 o'clock, there will be a bus taking people to the Capitol Hilton. It's going to run twice. So if you miss the second bus, you can either get an Uber or you can walk. There's more information on that on the sheet of paper behind your agenda in your folder. Is that right? Okay. And finally, a lot of the things that we talk about here are controversial, and a number of people who are participants here are very passionate about their point of view. And I just want to make a plea in a city which is horribly divided and polarized, where each side of any argument accuses the other side of base motives or idiocy. I'm hoping that we can be an island of civility here. It is not appropriate for someone from the municipal bond industry to accuse every academic of being an ivory tower egghead who knows nothing about how the market really works, nor is it appropriate for some academic to suggest that everybody who's in the municipal bond market is a rent-seeking, blood-sucking parasite on our society. So now that I've got that out of the way, I hope that we can have a lively conversation, because there are differences of point of view, and we learn something by disagreements, but to do it in a civil manner. And with that, I'd like to start the first panel. Dan, are you going to present? So we're going to start with Dan Bergstresser from Brandeis, who's going to talk about municipal advisors, and then he'll be followed by Marion Edmonds from the Public Resources Advisory Group, and then I'll come up and moderate a conversation. So, Dan, the floor is yours. Thank you.
Do you want me to stay up here after?
Should I stay up here?
Makes sense. Can you hear me okay in the back? Alan, Andy, can you hear me? So thanks so much for having me out to present this paper that is jointly authored with Marty Luby at the University of Texas. I should say, David started with a plea for civility. Marty and I think, behaved somewhat uncivilly in the late date at which we finished our paper. So I think the final draft of this paper was made available at about 10:30 last night. And so we apologize for that violation of even before the conference, we've sort of broken the civility. Our approach here, we're updating work that my co-author, Marty Luby, had done with Bart Hildreth, where they were looking in 2014, using data in 2012, at the size, the structure, the activities in the municipal advisor market. And so it seems natural at this point, now that we're at 2018, to reevaluate the evolution of that market in the period since the Dodd-Frank reforms. We also have some preliminary work that looks at the impact or the relationship between municipal advisor characteristics and the price increase of newly issued bonds in the immediate secondary market. The tables and the paper for this conference are available on the conference website. The main work that we've done here is to put together data from the Securities and Exchange Commission, which we downloaded and processed by hand, all of the municipal advisor filings, both for the firms and for the individuals, as well as the withdrawal filings for the firms that have withdrawn, put together with that with data from the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board. So in some sense, gives us the ability to compare who does the MSRB think is serving as an advisor and who does the SEC think is serving as an advisor, and think about the similarities, the differences between those perspectives. And we've merged that with data from the mergent, sort of the benchmark fixed income reference database for the municipal bond market. And I should say that all of these, putting together these different data sources involves sort of hand matching, which we'll make, if you send us an email, we'll share those hand match mappings between the different databases, because it's not a trivial part of the work here. So if you have to leave, if you only had 10 minutes for this conference, I realize it's a two-day conference, if you have to leave early, you don't even have to read the paper. You can just go to the MSRB website. And what you'll find on the website, at least a couple of days ago, was that you've got 525 firms listed that have an advisor who has passed the Series 50 exam. If you go to the SEC's website, you're going to find 593 firms listed as having currently serving as municipal advisors. And so an additional 221 firms have officially let the SEC know that they have withdrawn from the municipal advisory business. Of those 593 firms, we know these firms to be active because you can track their activity in the Mergent database. So the Mergent database is based on official statements, and so the official statements indicate who was the financial advisor. But of these 593 firms, it turns out that a number of these firms appear, based on what we've been able to get from the SEC. It appears that they haven't updated their municipal advisor filings. 39 haven't updated since 2014. 182 appear not to have updated their filings since 2016. And the reason why this matters, right, so beyond, having some concern about the perception of the integrity of the data collection in this market, there are a number of questions that you might be interested in. So, for example, if you're interested in understanding how concentrated, how oligopolistic is the municipal advisor market, right? If you are assuming that the firms are updating their MA filings every year, right, and saying, okay, well, let's look at the set of firms that filed in this year, you're going to get one picture. So looking at just the firms that are updating their filings every year, it would paint a picture of a market that is where the concentration is increasing much faster than if you say, wait a second, let's look at the set of firms that filed maybe in 2014, haven't updated, right, but haven't let us know that they were withdrawn. There, the picture that you get of the market is that it's actually the concentration in the market is not increasing as quickly. And our suspicion, we don't know for sure, but what we think is going on is that there are patterns across advisors in terms of how punctilious they are about keeping their filings updated. And that's going to matter. I mean, if you're a policymaker trying to get your arms around how concentrated this market is, if you're involved in a litigation context where somebody is, an issuer is unhappy with the quality of the placement of their bonds, you can imagine these questions about what is the market structure of this market being actually very difficult to answer because of the potential that you have firms that are active in the market but that are not consistently updating their filings. So that's the punchline. Here's the outline of what we will actually have time to do in this talk is some subset of this. We'll talk about registration activity. We'll talk about I'm going to talk about the evidence on the firm characteristics. What type of advice it seems that municipal advisors are giving. Information about the regulatory actions, the required disclosure around violations and convictions. We'll talk about some characteristics of the municipal advisor individual professionals because we have access to the MAI. We can say something about their career trajectories based on the individual filings that we have. And then the final analysis, we're going to look at the relationship between the characteristics of the municipal advisors, right? The characteristics of municipal advisors and some evidence on the patterns of price increases in the immediate post-issuance market. Right? So this is these data come directly from the MSRB with no merging with any other data sources. So if you look at the total number of firms that are registered with the MSRB, did y'all not give me a laser? So no laser. So it would violate the terms of my parole actually to give me a laser. So better than I not have it. This is according to the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board. This is the total number of advisors active in each year, and showing the number of initial registrations and the number of withdrawals. And two things that I think I want to point out if you're trying to get your arms around these data. The first is that you have a spike in withdrawals in 2014. When the Dodd-Frank registration, when the requirements under Dodd-Frank are finalized. The other thing that's interesting is that you have another spike in withdrawals in 2017. in our senses that those withdrawals are withdrawals in the post-Series 50 regime. So starting September of 2017, in order to be active in this business, you have to pass the Series 50 exam. And in that sort of post-exam regime, you're seeing a lot of withdrawals starting in 2017. If you want to look at initial registrations by type of firm, and here we've just cut it into two types, right? So the lighter blue is the firms that are just a municipal advisor, and the darker blue, the smaller, are the firms that are both advisors and dealers. And so you're seeing kind of a stable share of the folks doing advisory work that are also serving as dealers, right? So the dealers are not entirely withdrawing from the market. If you look at the withdrawals, not surprisingly, the bulk of the withdrawals are in the firms that are the smaller businesses. So what you're seeing is that the smaller advisory firms are the ones where you see the larger number of withdrawals. So the big takeaway from this, the registration withdrawals with the MSRB accelerate in 2014 with an uptick in 2017, and the decline in registrations is mostly coming from the withdrawals of the smaller firms. So another slide of takeaways, 525 firms have anybody who has ever passed the Series 50. The median of these 525 firms has two employees, right? So the median firm is a pretty small firm, but the median advisor works at a firm that has 21 advisors that have passed the exam. So if you're it's a little bit, you have to be careful. Are you talking about the typical firm, the typical advisor, because they are going to be pretty different, right? So going quickly through the firm characteristics. So this is, here we're going to the SEC data, and two things to point out. The first is we're mapping from the SEC data to the MSRB data, and that mapping is pretty good, right? So we're able to map almost every firm from the SEC data to the MSRB data. And then we're also able to map to the mergent data. Some firms don't show up in the mergent data, not because of a problem with the mapping, but because the mergent data are based on issuance. So you can have an advisor who is giving advice but not involved in issuance, but they won't show up in the mergent data just because they're not involved in issuance. They're giving other types of advice. And the thing that this, maybe it's not clear from this table, but the thing that really jumps out to us as we do this analysis is that you have to be careful if you're trying to assess the condition of this market, so who's active in this market. It does seem that you have to be careful to, you know, you have to make some judgment about, on the question of, if you have an advisor who hasn't officially withdrawn from the business, right, are they still active, right? Because the nature of what the population of municipal advisors looks like will look very different depending on whether you assume that the advisors are updating their filings as they're supposed to be, or if you say, well, they last filed something in 2014, they seem to still be in the business based on, you know, we see them giving advice, but we don't see them updating the registration, right? Another place where this matters, right? So this is, I love this graph. So if you assume that the firms active are the ones that are updating their filings with the SEC, you actually see the number of employees collapses in 2016, right? And what that reflects, we think, is that you just have a lot of firms that are not updating their filings. This is the number of municipal advisor professionals. This is the number of clients. The tall blue line is the total number of clients of municipal advisors of 20,000, which we think is order of magnitude in line with the size of the business. But if you make the assumption that is implicit in the light blue bar, which is that only the firms that you see updating their filing, those are the ones that are active in the business, it looks like the business is shrinking in magnitude more than it may actually be. Again, we're talking about something that is inherently kind of a dark matter problem. Like if they're not filing, then we kind of don't know what they're doing, and so you have to make some kind of a assumption, right? Types. I'll go very quickly through this. This, the types of clients appears to be pretty static over time. The types of other things that they're doing, right? So again, reasonably static. So it looks like 25% of the firms are also reporting that they're doing broker-dealer activities. One interesting thing to us is you see a lot of penetration of firms that are also doing investment advice. And really interestingly, you see firms that are also reporting that they provide services as attorneys, as accountants, engineering, that are playing a role in this market. Right? So this is the main takeaway. Depending on the assumption that you make about this kind of dark matter, right? So what is the case for the firms that you kind of suspect are still in the business but are not updating their filings? It looks like you could paint a picture on one hand of an advisory business where the size is collapsing. On the other hand, it's not clear that that's the case. And that's going to affect, if somebody files a lawsuit, like any expert witness who is making a judgment on the patterns in this market is going to have to make an assumption about what's actually going on here. Is this a market that's becoming increasingly concentrated or not? Right? And you can imagine, with very, very apparently subtle differences in what they assume, getting very different results of any analysis of this market. Right? So type of advice. I have a minute 20 left to go again. So, and I want to be absolutely as civil as I can. So I'm not gonna go over. I will say that issuance advice, derivatives advice, the results are in the paper. I wanna go quickly on the thing I want to say about the regulatory and violation disclosure is that two patterns appear to be at work in the data. The first pattern is that when you do have a violation, the firms seem to update their MA filings. So that is an occasion where you're going to get an update. At the same time, the types of firms that have more potential for problem, there's this unobserved compliance tendency or sort of punctiliousness tendency. And so exactly the assumption that you make about what is the behavior of the firms here in terms of compliance with the filing requirement will drive your interpretation of the evidence that you find in the data. Right. The advisors at small firms looks like they're working a lot on other jobs as well, not surprisingly. At the big firms, it looks like the advisors, that's kind of their primary obligation. At the smaller firms, it looks like that's not as much. They're meaningfully engaged in other activities. The last piece of analysis that I want to present is something that we're doing, and this is leading off of work that Marty Luby had done earlier, where we're looking at the relationship between advisor characteristics and the immediate post-issuance price increase in the bonds. And what we find is two facts that I want to highlight. The first is that depending on the specification, right? So it's significant sort of on the far left. You can kill it by putting in other variables. But it looks like at the advisors where there's a tighter intensity of the link to the underwriter. So advisors that work more consistently with one underwriter, you're seeing a tendency to have more of a price increase in the immediate post-issuance market based on, now that's a result that you can kill if you put in enough other variables, right? And you always have to be careful because these things are highly collinear. Concentration of advisor by state, right? So the advisors that are operating across more states seem to have a smaller amount of price increase in the immediate secondary market. So the more national advisors appear, if that's a measure of kind of quality of placement, it seems that the advisors that are operating across multiple states, you're seeing a higher quality of execution there. So the conclusions, in capital, maybe we've made a mistake somehow. But what it seems to be the case is that there are a lot of folks out there who are active in this market who are not being punctilious about updating their filings, and so that's the big result. And then there's some additional analysis on the number and composition of advisors and the relationship between advisor characteristics and the immediate secondary market. Thanks very much. Turn the laser back on for you.
Oh, I don't need a laser.
Okay.
I wouldn't know how to use it.
That's the danger.
Do we have slides? Okay.
Yes.
All right, so how do I do this? Okay. Okay, you need to give me some guidance here. We're using my time as we speak.
You just push these.
Push these? Okay, I'll go back. So I'm really concerned about how academic research might impact regulation and how we might have people take the results of these studies and use them to regulate. And that concern comes from the fact that I actually sat on the MSRB during the time that Rule G42 was developed. And so I participated in conversations where we fought over things like what was fiduciary duty and what would the registration look like. I've been on the front lines of this for a long time. So I started at the back, at the stuff that Dan hardly got to talk about, because I thought that these were the places where there were takeaways and policy suggestions that could have an impact on my business and my practice, and that I thought maybe weren't exactly accurate. So why didn't I think they were accurate? The data is robust but incomplete, I would say. And we'll get to some specifics about that in a minute. But let me go through the takeaways. The in the paper, which I did read last night, I actually read it in draft form on Tuesday, but I also read it at 11 last night. In the paper, there's a suggestion that because if there's a concentration between the business done with a pair, underwriter, MA pair, that you don't get as good a pricing. The data says that the average bond price increase is greater during the 30-day period, which means that your pricing maybe wasn't efficient to begin with. That's a pretty strong statement to make, especially if you look at places like Iowa where there probably aren't a whole lot of advisors trying to get that business. So I think that conclusion is a strong conclusion, and I question, what's missing in that. So one of the things that I think that's missing is the whole discussion of how you do that average bond price increase, and I probably will call for the data, though I probably wouldn't understand it if I got it. I think it's really important that there are differences in between states. I mean, the legal structure for every state is different, and the legal and add in District of Columbia and the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, and we got a whole lot of baggage to sort out in terms of how deals are structured. We've got differences in size of deals. So how a $1.9 billion offering by DASNY last week is going to be absorbed by the market is going to be different than how a $1.2 million special assessment deal from Florida gets absorbed by the market. So you're going to see there's all sorts of things here that need to be sorted out. Maturity matters when we're looking at price. You know, we know that price volatility is sensitive to coupon and maturity. So we would have to sort out those variables as well. And since I haven't seen the specific data, I'm going to assume that perhaps those things weren't taken into account. And finally, you know, there's the whole issue of competitive versus negotiated sale. And I don't know whether that was sorted or not either. So certainly if you're doing a competitive sale, it's sort of hard to argue that the change in the average bond price is related to the relationship between the underwriter and the MA. So the second policy suggestion that I took away from the paper was the idea that in-state advisors did not get as efficient a pricing as a national advisor would get. Now, I'm a national advisor. I show up in an official statement as Public Resources Advisory Group, St. Petersburg, Florida. So I don't know how the data, you know, sorts me. But I do know that that because of the differences between state markets and the differences between how business is conducted in, I'll use Iowa again, and how business is conducted in Florida, I would be really worried about, you know, making sure that you found advisors to use in Florida who had never worked in Florida before. I mean, there are regional differences that are so subtle that it does make a difference. And I don't think that this difference in the average bond price increase has been that there has been enough data to really erase the benefit that comes from having local knowledge and local presence. And so I found that to be a really big part of my practice, and I would be surprised if when we really dug into the data, if that were a positive factor. And then this whole issue of regulatory violations and disclosures and criminal activity. And I just have to say, I can't fathom the numbers. The numbers don't make sense that I saw in the slides and in the paper. There have been, I guess, in the SEC's, the OCIE's, I got that right, examination group, when they published their findings in November, said that in 2 years they had looked at 110 firms. I think I've got that number right. So if they looked at 110 firms out of 507 firms, how could we have, you know, 40% or 45% of the firms having violations? I'm really not clear on that. The examinations are covering 70 to 80 firms a year. So I just can't fathom how we have this number of violations, and I'd love to see the data that shows that. I think this is a practitioner's perspective. I would never tell a client not to pay attention to regulatory violations. It goes against my best judgment and my intuition. I just can't see doing that. So, you know, I'm not saying anything that Dan and Marty didn't actually say in their paper. You know, they said the data was confounding, or they were confounded by the data. I want to talk a bit about the emergent data. I'll come back to that. But I'd say that these issues with the data are not a minor inconvenience, that the data isn't strong enough to make policy based on these results. And I actually have a question about the merchant data, because as a practitioner, I don't use it. I mean, I don't see it. I don't use it. I'm lucky if I can get an SEC run. But when I went to the merchant website to investigate and understand who they were, one of the things that they had posted on their website was that they took information from OSs of issuers who had $25 million or more of debt outstanding. Now, that may be an issue with the website not having been updated, but if it's in fact accurate, we've lost a whole part of the market with that data, because there are a whole lot of issuers who have less than $25 million of debt outstanding. And if we haven't included those, then we've missed some important factors. When I was trying to understand the regression data, because I got my MBA a whole long time ago and had maybe one statistics class, and I don't need to use it much anymore, so I went poking around the internet to educate myself quickly and found a nice little, you know, business article in the Harvard Business Review, which we know has things that you can read quickly and sort of give you fast information, we hope accurate. But the thing that I took away from that article was this chart that was talking about making business decisions. But the idea was, if you're making a business decision and it's going to cost you a lot of money, you want to make sure your data is really strong. So, you know, this is where I'm not looking at this from a conversational standpoint of, oh, wouldn't it be interesting to know how advisors, I'm looking at this as, I don't want the MSRB to start regulating based on the data in this paper. I don't want to see rules that we have to have out-of-state advisors working with local issuers. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me, and I think we have to really consider the value of that. Other considerations. You know, we know the municipal market is wildly diverse. We heard, 50,000 issuers in 50 states plus other political jurisdictions. We have healthcare, education, enterprise funds, water, sewer, solid waste, airports, seaports. They all get viewed differently, and I do not think you can take all that data and just throw it in one big pool. You have to, you know, this is the start. You take this data and you use this data to figure out what else you have to look at. So with that, my time's up, and I guess we go on to the next stage.
Thank you both. I think it is the kind of dialogue we're trying to encourage. I'm gonna ask the audience, because we're limited in time. I'm gonna ask the audience if they want to have any questions, and then we can have Dan. You can respond to
one thing that I want to.
Okay.
On the question of the count of violations, there's one exhibit in the paper that I think is potentially you have to look at it for a second to understand. It's there's a percent in there, and there are violations in there. And the violations are as a total of the total count of violations by type of violations. And so the 40, if you say, 40% of the violations are SEC violations, that does not mean that 40% of the firms report a violation. That's of the set of firms that report some kind of a violation or some kind of a disclosure event. 40% are in that category. The total number of, Marianne, you're exactly right. Your instinct is right that the violations, the disclosure events are a rare event. And I apologize for the, I think we could have done a better job making a less misleading table, but the data are right for what they are, just the denominator.
Okay. I have some questions, but I want to give, yes, in the back. So here's the rule. Tell us who you are, stand up, and make it short.
All right. Will do. This is Terry Finn with Sturm Brothers. I was wondering, in the data, did you differentiate between negotiated and competitive underwritings? And then also, did you differentiate between credit quality amongst any of the analysis?
On the price increase in the secondary market, there are six columns in there. And the first four were not differentiating between competitive and negotiated. And the final two, we're using the kind of the residual controlling for a bunch of characteristics, including the competitive versus negotiated. So it's the competitive are in the sample, but there is it's controlling for kind of what you think of as a dummy variable. So in the final two, it's controlled for, but it's not in the first four. And that's the way in general that I approach data, is that you start controlling for nothing, and then you sort of work your way towards
credit quality.
No, absolutely not controlled for credit quality. We will, but no.
Don Lloyd.
Wait, Don, why don't you wait for the mic?
UAlbany. Two quick questions. Could you say something about whether the price increases were large or not? And the other is it possible that there were characteristics of the issuers? Were they all the Iowas that had the price increases, and maybe that had something to do with it?
A typical price increase would be in the order of magnitude of 0.15 or 0.2% of the par value of the bond. So I think that's the average price increases are not. I think some folks have said, well, you'll see 1% or 2%. We're not finding that in our data. Typical is much smaller than that. And then what was the second question?
Whether it might have been the characteristics of the issuers, the Iowas, maybe
versus FAR.
Yeah, done some work to control for that, and certainly once you start controlling for things, because you're dealing with data that are very collinear, you can take any relationship and make it no longer statistically significant by putting in enough controls.
Marianne, I wonder what you could, if you could speak. So I get your point that if you have shaky data, you could get bad policy, and I also get your point that, I mean, one of the reasons we want to have a practitioner here is to say somehow this doesn't feel right to me, given my experience in the business. But what I'm curious about is whether you think it's useful or even possible to look across all municipal advisors and do this analysis in a way that tells us anything, or do you think it's just so much idiosyncrasy between among jurisdictions and stuff that this kind of analysis is not useful?
Did I turn this on?
Yep, you did.
Okay. I think it is useful. I think it's hard to go across jurisdictions. I think it's hard to go across credits, but I think it can be done. It's just a very, you know, I'm not the academic who could do that. But I do think that there's a way to sort of take data and intuition and pull them together and work that way. So, no, I don't think – I wouldn't be here if I thought it was a useless proposition.
And the finding about which we have the highest level of confidence is that whatever somebody reports that they're finding in this market is going to be sensitive to the assumption that they make about the reliability with which advisors are updating their filings. Like, that is, if you take away one sentence from this entire talk, it would be that.
All right, Steve
over there in the back.
I think Don...
Steve Winterstein.
Steve Winterstein, Wilmage Trust. Thank you, David. Don alluded to this, but what would make sense to me is to start to divide the market, not only by state or region, but then by sector, and then seeing certain municipal advisors have certain kinds of practices, and then maybe looking at those microcosms and start to divine a little bit of information out of those who do. There are municipal advisors, for example, who only do airports, or that's the majority of their practice. That might be interesting. So if you start to create vectors, if you will, and examine it from that perspective, there may be something a little more intuitive.
Dan, how comfort are you about the, I mean, Marianne was right to pick up the most sort of incendiary findings at the end are the ones that you suggest that certain relationships between advisors and issuers lead to worse outcomes. You know, the implication is sort of there's too much familiarity between the advisor and the municipality and they don't get much going. How confident are you about the regression stuff? Would you, if you were on sitting on the Waltham City Council, would you use this to make decisions about what municipal advisor to use? I'm not going to go that long.
I would give it a weight that was strictly greater than zero. I would give it some weight. I will bet any one of my paired organs that. Sorry, did I say that out loud? Sorry about that. I'll bet a lot. We are highly confident in the finding that what you think is going on in this market is going to be very, very sensitive to the way that you handle the data. And what we thought was a pretty subtle thing, which is if you as a researcher or you as a policymaker are assuming that people are punctiliously updating their filings, like that is something that you cannot assume. And you can find very, very different stuff based on what appears to be pretty subtle ways of treating the data. And I think Marianne's, what I detect is a certain suspicion of, regression analysis or a certain suspicion of statistical analysis in this context does resonate with me on the basis of an ability to, you know, paint one picture based on what would appear ex ante to be a reasonable way to handle the data, and then paint a totally different picture based on what also is a pretty reasonable way to handle the data. So I think that is a concern. The only thing that we can do as researchers is be as transparent as we can about what we've done. You know, we'll share the code with you. I think that the paper was written so quickly and delivered last night that I think in terms of the transparency that is actually reflected in the paper, it's just not there yet.
So it sounds to me like you would not, if you were on the City Council of Waltham, based only on this work, fire the municipal advisor who happens to live in Billerica just because it's nearby.
The way that The way that that variable is constructed is that it's the state concentration of the advisor is based on the firm, right? So it's not a characteristic of the advisor. It's based on a given firm mapping from that firm to the bond issuance recorded in the Burgeant database. How concentrated is that firm in terms of operating within one state or operating more nationally? So it's not a characteristic of the individual advisor. You could have a firm that is a national firm that is made up of individual advisors that each have a local knowledge. And so I'm sympathetic to what Marianne is saying, and I think we can be, what we capture there is a characteristic. In that regression, we're capturing a characteristic that's a firm-level characteristic and not an individual characteristic.
No, actually, I don't have much to add to that. I did have one thought that I just completely lost, so I'll hand it back to you.
We'll get that later. George, can you wait for the mic?
Sure. Don't need it, but I'll wait for it. George Friedlander, Court Street Group. One of the issues I have with this stuff is the way some of the variables cascade, and I'll just give you two examples. One, more complex and weak credits come negotiated, and that is likely to mean more variability in the price in the aftermarket. I see Marianne nodding her head, so I'm glad to see that. So it's not just this kind of piles on what Steve was talking about. The nature of the security affects whether it's negotiated or competitive, which affects the volatility, and that's tricky. The second one, real quick, the change in the role of the direct retail investor, which started really dramatically in 2010, is going to change the way the data looks on competitive versus negotiated. And I'm just suggesting that may be something you want to take a look at.
Okay. Final question, Linda. Can you just wait for the mic?
Linda Mankowski, Stern Brothers. I guess.
Linda Mankowski.
Dan, I would agree with you intuitively on the state concentration issue from the standpoint that when you have advisory firms that are concentrated in one state, where they're doing a disproportionate large number of those issues, they do tend to track their pricing within state. So this is an opportunity maybe to have, some of those firms go back in and maybe benchmark out of state, because that would potentially account for some of the data that you're seeing where those firms' internal policy is to track intra-state and not necessarily track out of state. So their pricing could become a sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
And do you have a brief response to that or anything else?
No, I just want to say thanks to Marianne for very thoughtful and helpful comments. And I apologize for the various breaches of civility in terms of the late delivery of the paper and my comments just now, and all of the breaches that will come in the future. I'll sort of apologize now.
And we'll discuss which of your paired organs you're going to sacrifice as a result.
Like a kidney.
Okay. Now we're going to turn to the next paper, the impact of Dodd-Frank on credit ratings and bond yields in municipal securities. And Chantal LaFontant from Indiana University will make the presentation.
Do I need to use the clicker, or could I?
Yes.
Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Chantal LaFontant. I'm a PhD candidate at SPIA, School of Public Environmental Affairs at Indiana University. Today, along with my co-authors, Dr. Johnson and Dr. Abbas, we're going to overview the impact. We're going to go over our research about the impact of Dodd-Frank on S&P credit ratings and bond yields. And we're going to be focusing on the municipal securities case. So before we go into the details about our research, I thought I'd present a summary of what our research findings were. First, in terms of credit ratings, we find empirical support that there is a disciplining effect occurring after Dodd-Frank on S&P ratings. There were higher ratings, more stable ratings, fewer total rating changes, fewer overall negative rating actions, and fewer overall downgrades, and more rating upgrades. We also find stability and change in the credit rating model. Now, in terms of bond yields, what we find is that after Dodd-Frank, bond yields are lower, and the impact is significant across all rating classes. The yield spread across rating classes is wider. We find no significant impact for non-rated bonds also. And next, we also find that recently upgraded bonds are associated with a significantly greater reduction in yield spread after Dodd-Frank in comparison to those bonds with already established ratings. So for those of you who are not familiar with Dodd-Frank, I'm going to give you a very brief overview. First, the law was signed by President Obama on July 21st, 2010. Over 2,300 pages of new laws intended to fundamentally change how financial markets and the financial service providers operate were made into law in 2010. What we're focusing on in our case is on subtitle C from title in Dodd-Frank. What Dodd-Frank does, it goes on to strengthen what was already occurring with the Credit Rating Agency Reform Act of 2006. First, in 2006, what happened was that the SEC, for the first time, was given authority to regulate credit rating agencies. And established into law what credit rating agency could be certified as nationally recognized statistical rating organizations. In 2010, with the passage of Dodd-Frank, what happened is that the regulatory relationship of the SEC over CRAs was transformed from being mainly a clerical one to one that involved regulatory oversight in terms of oversight of internal operations, procedures, methodologies, and rating performance overall. So, what did Dodd-Frank do to try to increase the rating qualities being the rating quality of the ratings being issued by these credit rating agencies? What it did was increase regulatory risk and litigation risk. What you saw that there was a requirement for a universal rating symbol system put in place. All ratings across sectors had to mean the same thing. So, what that means is that issuers were required to produce a probability of issuer default. There had to be consistency across all types of securities. And also CRAs were required to review their system and methodologies to make sure that they were producing universal ratings and also make adjustments if that was not the case. In terms of litigation risk, what you saw happening was that municipal CRAs were now culpable for material misstatements and fraud, and further increased liability exposure for issuing inaccurate ratings. So what we saw here was an opportunity to determine whether a reputation effect or a disciplinary effect was taking place in terms of the impact on CRAs from Dodd-Frank. And in our case, we were only focusing on S&P. So with the reputation hypothesis, the main takeaway with that is there is a theory that increased penalties will cause CRAs or might cause CRAs to issue lower ratings than warranted by the entity's credit fundamentals. And the logic of that is that there is less risk by issuing lower ratings than it would be to issue a rating that was too high in terms of probability of punishment. There are corporate studies that support the reputation theory out there, but also there's a conflicting theory called the disciplinary hypothesis, which argues that to reduce regulatory and legal exposures, CRAs will produce engage in more diligence, improve the methodology, increase the surveillance of operations, resulting in more accurate and informative ratings. What we're trying to do here is to see whether there's going to be a reputation or a disciplining effect taking place because of Dodd-Frank. We speculate that before we engage in our analysis, we speculated that's going to be a disciplining effect is going to take place because the muni market is fundamentally different in lots of in certain ways. First, default rates are much lower than in the corporate sector. CRAs are widely criticized for underrating the municipal sector. Dodd-Frank also enacts this requirement that there be that ratings be uniform, accurate, in line with what was stipulated with the Municipal Bond Fairness Act of 2008. And most importantly, there are a lot of key ways that the municipal market differs from other markets. First, this sector is not subjected to the same comprehensive primary and secondary market financial disclosure regulations as you see in the corporate sector. Second, not all issuers follow GASB accounting standards. And when they do, the reporting is often delayed or it's incomplete. And third, the secondary market is opaque, dominated by individual investors and not institutional investors. For these reasons, we speculate that it's more likely that a disciplining effect is going to occur in this market because of after Dodd-Frank. So our expected empirical impacts that we think we're going to see here is that after Dodd-Frank, there's going to be higher ratings, lower bond yields, reduced downward rating bias, there's going to be greater rating stability, and because of that, you're going to see adjustments taking place more often in terms of how they produce these ratings in the municipal sector. Okay. So we're going to start looking at what we were empirically able to get in terms of results from our credit rating data. We used an Orbit Probit. We had 418 S&P observations from 38 states, and these were geo ratings from 2004 to 2014 at year end. Our core model involved variables, independent variables of budget revenue, tax ratio, population, unemployment, debt, and other CAFR financial data. Our main test variable is the after Dodd-Frank variable for year-end ratings between 2010 and 2014, and pre-Dodd-Frank here is defined as 2004 to 2009. So our main takeaway from our empirical observations using this data here is that in our base model, ratings were significantly higher after Dodd-Frank. In the base model and also in our interactive model, we find that S&P's model shows both stability and change, meaning certain independent variables did change after Dodd-Frank, and these were population, debt, and tax ratio. Also, we produced a chi-square test that indicates that the interactive after Dodd-Frank model has a greater predictive power. So next, we looked at ratings outlooks and rating actions. And the results were in line from what we saw looking at the credit rating data. After Dodd-Frank, overall rating actions decreased. Total negative actions also decreased. And the few rating changes that did occur involved fewer downgrades and increased upgrades. So this provides more empirical support that there is greater rating stability after Dodd-Frank. Next, let's look at our yield data. We had nearly 23,000 state geo bond yields to look at from 2004 to 2015. Our base model is very similar to what you just saw before. We use year and state fixed effects with robust standard errors. Now, our expectations here were that there would be lower yields and that the yield differences across rating classes will be wider. Our empirical results basically support what we expected. Yields after Dodd-Frank are lower, and for newly issued bonds, the finding is significant across all rating classes. There are no significant changes found for non-rated bonds. Also, the yield risk spread is higher after Dodd-Frank, and the yield spread between newly upgraded bonds and bonds with established ratings narrow after Dodd-Frank. So, what were our conclusions from our research? Dodd-Frank had significant impact on ratings and yields. Credit ratings significantly higher after Dodd-Frank, as well as more stable, as evidenced by fewer total rating changes. Further, there were fewer overall negative rating actions, fewer rating downgrades, and more rating upgrades after Dodd-Frank. S&P increased state credit ratings and it changed its credit rating model in response to the increased litigation and regulatory risk after Dodd-Frank, but without a public announcement of doing so. Further, when looking at the bond yields, bond yield data, our conclusions were that bond yields were lower across all rating classes after Dodd-Frank, no evidence of before and after yield differential for non-rated bonds existed, and Dodd-Frank impacted yields through ratings. Market uses after Dodd-Frank, the market uses after Dodd-Frank information to further separate bond yields based on their default risk. And further, the market interpreted post-Dodd-Frank rating upgrades as providing new positive information. And overall, the empirical evidence supports the disciplining hypothesis and not the reputation hypothesis. Dodd-Frank, in the end, because they increased the regulatory and litigation risk involved for CRAs, had its intended effect. The underlying quality of these credit ratings issued by S&P did improve. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ashton Goodfield, and I am with DWS, recently formerly known as Deutsche Asset Management. And I have the pleasure of talking about this paper today. I agree with the authors that studying the accuracy and of credit rating agencies and the responsiveness and their impact in the market is valuable, and it's valuable particularly in the municipal bond market. As people have already talked about today, the municipal market is an opaque and fragmented market, and with, as someone said before, over 50,000 issuers, disclosure is not what we have in other markets. Requirements are not the same, as you mentioned, in investment-grade corporates, for example, and then compliance with the requirements is not adequate. And also, it is, as pointed out in the paper, it's a retail-oriented market. So retail buyers have more of a need of accurate credit ratings than institutional investors that have more resources to apply to credit research. I believe that the credit rating agencies help push issuers to comply with disclosure guidelines, and they help parse large volumes of data, financial economic data, and generally help improve the collection and dissemination of good quality information and timely information to municipal investors. So credit rating agencies provide a valuable service to investors and that it is important to have specific transparent requirements and transparent methodology for the ratings, and Dodd-Frank helped with that, and that is helpful to the market, has been helpful to the market. In my view, the authors offered effective arguments countering the reputation hypothesis, and they gave compelling arguments in support of the disciplining hypothesis. I suggest, though, that the study would be more robust if we had an element of context that I think is missing, and that is the story of the municipal insurer downgrades in the municipal market. I'd also like to address a couple of premises and conclusions that I think need a little bit more support. But first, let me talk about the monoline insurers for a moment and the downgrades and their impact on the market. As you can see here, I just picked random dates, the end of 2007 and the end of 2017, to show the difference in ratings of the municipal market when the monoline insurers were rated AAA. And, you know, over 50% of new issues were insured and rated AAA. And so we had 69% of the market rated AAA in the end of 2007. 10 years later, 14% of the market rated AAA. And then if you look at the single A ratings, 7% of the market was rated single A before, and now at the end of 17, 25% roughly are rated single A. So a very big change in the dispersion of ratings in the municipal market. And it's really all the more reason that the rating agencies need to provide timely and accurate information. I realize that credit rating agencies are being held to a higher standard with Dodd-Frank, not because of any mistakes they made in rating municipals, but rather mistakes made in rating structured product. But it was the structured product ratings that impacted the decline of ratings of the monoline insurers, and obviously that had a huge impact on ratings in the municipal market. It also had a big impact on the confidence that municipal investors had in the credit rating agencies, because now the ratings are so much different than they were before. So it did generate this a bit of crisis of confidence in the credit rating agencies. I'm not convinced that Dodd-Frank has completely overcome that. There remains a major conflict of interest, and this was brought up in the paper, and I think we all know that there is a conflict of interest in the way that credit rating agencies are paid. They're paid by the issuers, and they're also paid by the insurers. Another element about the insurers and the market having been insured so to such a degree before is that I think that maybe investors were a little less concerned about the accuracy of credit rating agencies before, because if you owned a security that was rated single A but it was insured, how much did you really care whether the outlook changed because it was still AAA insured? So I think there was a little less scrutiny before about the rating agency ratings when the bonds were insured AAA. I don't have data to support this, but I think you could make an argument that the lower ratings were something that the insurers liked because it helped provide incentive for investors to buy bonds with insurance. So it doesn't necessarily contradict the discipline hypothesis, but I think that it's a context that needs to be mentioned to see the full picture of what's been going on in the market over time. Just to also show a little bit of the lack of or the reduction of confidence that investors had after the financial crisis and the downgrades of the insurers, we saw a lot of hiring of municipal analysts, credit analysts, after the financial crisis. In the municipal market, buy side and sell side was both sides were hiring a lot of municipal analysts. It was both partly because of the wider dispersion of ratings, but also you could argue because of possibly less confidence in credit rating agencies after the financial crisis. Another thing I want to talk about is how the market anticipates changes in credit ratings. The study talks a lot about changes after credit ratings, changes in levels, trading levels after credit ratings changed. But I think you can see a lot of market anticipation of credit rating changes. So it does conflict a bit with the disciplining hypothesis when we see, for example, last September, just to pick a point in time, Connecticut GOs and Pennsylvania GOs were both rated A-plus stable. So this is around the end of September 2017. Connecticut was trading about 80 basis points cheaper than AAA, and Pennsylvania GOs were trading about 55 basis points cheaper than AAA. So Connecticut was trading 25 basis points wider in spread than Pennsylvania, and yet they were rated the same. You could even argue that since taxes are higher in Connecticut as a specialty state, maybe they should trade richer, but yet they were trading 25 basis points cheaper. So it shows you that the investors are giving a bigger difference in credit ratings than the credit rating agencies. And you know, it's ironic that we're talking about Connecticut because the paper points out that Connecticut was the first state that sued the credit rating agencies for giving them ratings that were too low. After the end of September, Connecticut, sure enough, was given a negative outlook and then was downgraded, and the spreads remain wider today. The paper talks about recalibrating the ratings and this being a positive because everyone knew that muni ratings, a muni single A rated bond was a higher credit quality than an investment grade corporate single A rated bond. And so that is an improvement for the market. And yet there is a feeling in the marketplace, and I remember a lot of discussion around this recalibration effort, and we still feel like this today, that the less granularity of ratings, as more state GOs specifically are upgraded, there's less granularity. And so less opportunity for signals from credit ratings if the ratings are all concentrated in smaller areas. So I think that that's an area where you don't have as much, maybe as I said, signals for the market. There is a point in the paper that higher and more stable ratings indicate better accuracy. I think this is a point that needs to be better supported. Recently, what we've heard a lot about is unfunded pension liabilities and OPEBs, other post-employment benefit obligations. And this is something that has prompted the rating agencies to change their ratings criteria to reflect this. I think this is appropriate. So I think it's appropriate for them to change their rating criteria. I mean, while it's good to have sustainable criteria, I think that there are aspects of the market that should prompt credit rating changes, and we've seen downgrades as a result. So I've run out of time, so I'm going to have to be really quick following the rest of it. The paper talks about higher ratings generating lower yields, we are in a market of we have been in a market of steadily declining yields, and the statistics do in the paper do account for that, but I'm not sure they account enough for tightening spreads. Over time, we've seen tighter spreads as rates have come down. So the part that I thought was more compelling is when you show that as states are downgraded, that the spreads widen. I think that's more compelling than showing when they're upgraded they narrow because most spreads were narrowing. As I said at the outset, I think this is important paper and serves a good purpose for the market. I think that it would be interesting to see a broader analysis of a wider scope of the muni market rather than state GOs, just so that we can make sure that how credit rating agencies can and do help inform buyers and municipals.
So I was kind of, as you were presenting your paper, I was thinking that for all the bad reputation that Dodd-Frank has in town, I'm surprised that I haven't seen bumper stickers that say, Dodd-Frank raised your municipality's credit rating and lowered what your municipality has to pay for borrowing. I have no comparative advantage here whatsoever. So I'm going to turn to the audience, and I'll let the authors and the discussants respond. Do you want to introduce yourself, Craig?
Yeah. Craig Johnson, Indiana University, School of Public and Environmental Affairs. Any questions?
Dan?
I'm having to remember 10 years ago, but I think that there were hearings in Congress about almost exactly 10 years ago, so in February of 2008, on exactly this notion that some of the tilt towards lower credit ratings for municipalities might be part of a market dynamic that encouraged people to buy insurance. And so I think Tom Doe wrote some stuff. I think Tom Doe was at that hearing. I think I'm remembering that history right, so that's...
Yeah, and to be very careful about that these days, because actually there's ongoing lawsuits regarding that. But I do think that, as was mentioned by the discussant, and her remarks were excellent, by the way. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Clearly, to me, the bond insurance industry benefited from a deflated municipal credit rating market, frankly. That, to me, is very clear. What's happening now and what will happen in the future, because the bond insurance industry is very different. I think they have a fundamentally different business model. But in the past, they have benefited, yes.
Can I ask a question about Chantel said that the difference between the yields has widened from AAA to AA. But Ashton, you said that the ratings tend to more cluster. So... those are obviously both, you could have both those things. But so is it basically, there's not that much difference among the gradings, so you're not that many issues to trade at a wider?
This one. There, is that on?
Yeah.
Now? Okay.
Good job.
There are fewer different ratings for the state since a lot of them have been upgraded. And that's a little bit separate from my saying that credit rating spreads generally have tightened.
No, but I think what Chantel said is, correct me if I'm right, that the difference between being a AAA and a AA in terms of your yield is wider than it was before Dodd-Frank.
Yes, it is.
Okay. But you're saying that more of the bonds end up in the...
I guess it depends on the time period that you're looking at, because since, you're looking at from 2010 to
after Dodd-Frank period is defined as 2010 to 2014, based on the data that we gathered. So if you have a different time period, you could see different effects occurring. But that's the time period that we covered.
And that would include 2013 when spreads widened a bit. Mm-hmm. So since that time, my perspective, since that time, spreads have tightened generally.
Kim Rubin, Urban Institute.
Oh, so I don't have to even introduce myself. So thank you, and this is really interesting and important. Something that came up last year at the conference was this question and this hypothesis about whether there were differential effects at the very top and the very bottom of the market. And what you were doing, were you able to look at whether there was more variance at the very top and the very bottom? Like, I'm just wondering if there's something that's nonlinear that you might be able to pick up, where if there's more or less variance within ratings in terms of yield spreads at the ends versus in the middle. Is there any of that? Can you see that in your data at all?
There's more variance. Well, there's more variance, kind of using your perspective, at the single A level than there is double A and triple A. So.
Bob Cherenko, University of Illinois, Chicago, and I'm on the steep part of the learning curve when it comes to the in and outs of the municipal market. But what I heard today so far about ratings is that I shouldn't really trust them, that they've been biased, there's lawsuits and so on and so forth. So I'm interested in whether or not the ratings are taken seriously in the municipal market and whether or not they should, and perhaps that's changed over time. Thank you.
I don't want to imply that they're not used. We look at the ratings, and we also look at analysis from the rating agencies. But from our perspective as investors, we also have independent analysis. We conduct independent analysis, and I think you'll find that across other investors and institutional investors that do their independent analysis and use the rating agencies as sort of a check and how the market might price bonds, and also use the analysis to see if we might be missing something. And then also, because it is a very much retail market, it does matter what things are rated, because if something's rated, you know, drops to BBB or even BBB and below, that's going to make spreads change dramatically. So they do provide some indication as to credit quality, but it is important, especially in this kind of opaque market, to conduct your own, we feel, independent research.
So my impression is that, from what you said, is that once upon a time when a lot of bonds were insured, the ratings didn't really matter very much, and the rating agencies were kind of under-resourced or lazy. Suddenly the monolines go away, and you don't have much anything. If you're a retail investor, suddenly the ratings make a big difference. And the second thing is this issue which the legislation addresses, which is, it's not fair that the corporate AA has a much greater risk of default than a municipal AA, and that was seen to be some affront to the issuers, right?
Yes.
And so I guess my question is, I'm building on that question a little bit. Today, do we believe that the rating agencies are doing a better job of evaluating municipal credits than they were before Dodd-Frank?
I think their work is more important now. Okay. I did not use the word lazy.
No, I did. part of my civility campaign.
I do think their work is more important now. I think that the paper points out ways in which there has been improvement and there should be more discipline, because there are more chances for litigation. So I would think that they are more accurate, but there's still a ways to go, and there's still the conflicts of interest.
Yeah. Another important thing is that we pointed out that muni sector, the institutional investor is less dominant in that sector, and there are more individual investors, and they tend to be more reliant on the credit rating as a way of gauging the default risk of that bond.
Yeah. Look, underlying ratings were always provided, even when bond insurance was prevalent. And I do think that underlying ratings always should have mattered. I do think we got to the point in the market where people were just paying attention to the AAA from the insurance company, and I think that was a mistake. I think in many areas the due diligence got a little slack, and I think in many ways we paid the price for that. I would hope that now, with bond insurance being more dormant and not being involved in as many issues, in my opinion, it's a more reasonable size market now, frankly, because many issues didn't need bond insurance in the past, frankly, in my opinion. The market was way oversaturated. I would hope that the credit rating agencies would be now even more diligent, frankly, in doing their work. And I would hope that the market would realize that, respect that, and would use the ratings even more. And then where the rating agencies were not doing what they needed to be doing, they would hold the rating agencies accountable, frankly. And that's one of the bigger issues to me with Dodd-Frank, is that now we have a regulated credit rating industry. And if the credit rating industry isn't doing what it needs to be done in terms of the making the market more efficient, more transparent, better, et cetera, I do think you have a lever at least to use to change the behavior of the credit rating agency, change the behavior of the credit rating industry. And I would encourage people to use that lever, frankly, that did not exist before.
I guess what I was getting at, I wasn't just intuitively, the fact that the average rating went up didn't tell me that we think they're doing a better job in distinguishing and the risk. There's a woman in the back there.
Hi there. I'm Kimberly Cornaja. I'm at Penn State University and formerly an employee at the Securities and Exchange Commission and a little bit familiar with what the SEC has purview to do and what the SEC does not have purview to do. I think, I'll try to be brief, there seems to be a misunderstanding of what Dodd-Frank did. Dodd-Frank is not a regulatory body. Dodd-Frank is a legislative act. The SEC has not regulated any of the three things that you're saying Dodd-Frank did, which means Dodd-Frank didn't do any of those three things, right? So there's a no-action letter written to Ford Motor Credit that completely took the teeth out of any litigation risk on the part of the rating agencies. So that aspect of Dodd-Frank is basically nullified. In terms of getting municipal bonds and corporate bonds, credit ratings to behave the same, a very thorough empirical analysis has demonstrated that is not possible, and therefore the SEC won't be trying to enforce that regulation either. The third thing is the SEC has never, and to this day does not have, any purview to even comment on, let alone regulate, credit rating methodology. The SEC's purview is to mitigate conflicts of interest, meaning they shouldn't be giving higher credit ratings to people who pay them more. That's all the SEC has basically a purview to regulate. They cannot even comment on credit rating methodology. So I do think, and maybe it's just a question of motivating your analysis differently, but the motivation that was given for the paper is that Dodd-Frank had teeth and did these three things. Dodd-Frank was not able to do any of those three things because the SEC is not enforcing those three things.
Well, I think from the credit rating agency's perspective, in my opinion, the only aspect that the SEC via the MSRB, via the Office of the Securities credit rating agencies, that they do not have any control over from a rating agency perspective is the methodology itself. Okay? They have reporting requirements that they have to meet, annual reporting requirements that they have to meet. And there's a variety of other measures that the credit rating agencies do, in my opinion, feel that they are under the regulatory structure, where they weren't under that structure at all before, not only prior to Dodd-Frank, but before 2006, before they were nationally recognized statistical rating organizations. That fundamental layout has changed, where they didn't have any real responsibility of reporting to any federal authority, whether it's the SEC, MSRB, or any other agency that comes up. It changed in 2006, and it also changed under Dodd-Frank. It is not this. They didn't have annual reporting requirements. We couldn't look at literally the reports that the rating agencies have to do in terms of defaults and producing the ratings relative to default probabilities for municipals and across the board. They didn't have to talk about their governance structures. They didn't have to talk about their boards. They didn't have to talk about conflicts of interest. They didn't have any of that reporting requirements to the federal government before. Yes, clearly that the regulation is not the same as it would be as if, well, let me back up here. The regulation could go farther, okay? But it's not the case where they feel that they are these private firms under no federal regulatory authority at all. And so the yeah, okay.
Those are all publicly available.
But there are also new, there's actually been new requirements posed almost every single year. The reporting requirements are a little bit different now than they were back in 2010 and before and in 2007. And we feel that the regulatory requirements, the reporting requirements should be even greater than they are now, frankly, so we can make those comparisons across markets.
Okay, point taken. All right, here's the plan. We have on the schedule a fifth. First of all, I want to thank the speakers and the discussant. We're going to take a 15-minute break. There should be coffee outside. We'll reassemble at 3 o'clock, and there's two sets of papers, and you get to pick. They're in your agenda. There'll be one in here. about, well, you can read it yourself. So one group will be in here, and one group will be in the other room. Thank you.